Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I.
Welcome to Radio Free Kanata. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with my co-host and brother, Ryan Gable. Welcome back, everyone. It's good to have you back. You can follow all of our archive programs at bbsradio.com/radiofreekanata. And it's right there. If you go down, all the archive shows are right there. People have been asking. And also, it's great to know that our listenership is increasingly growing. So thanks to all of our loyal listeners out there and the activists with the Republic who are making all of this come true. And in that note, I've got a short little announcement. We've talked in the past about our public people's assemblies that are gathering in September. And there's groups convening these assemblies or conducting educational work starting in September in the following 14 cities. And I want to mention these in case you're in one of them. Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, and Winnipeg in the West, Sault Ste. Marie, London, Toronto, and Minden, Ontario, including Ottawa and Cornwall, and in Quebec, Montreal, Quebec City, and Sherbrooke, and of course, Halifax on the East Coast. If you're in any vicinity near there, please contact us or write to republicofkanata@gmail.com, and we will put you in touch. Also, the encouraging thing is that, inspired by what we're doing, there's a whole network in Northern California and on the West Coast of America that's emulating our work and trying to set up similar assemblies in their communities. So please contact us, and we will connect you with them as well if you're an American listener. Today we're going to go into more of what we did last time, which was discussing the basis. What is the basis for us to declare not just individual but collective sovereignty and independence from these murderous institutions? And Ryan and I are going to talk about that, both internationally and also in terms of Kanata and the evidence we have, concerning genocide and other crimes in Canada. So, Ryan, welcome.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
I'm not sure if it's you or me, but there's a lot of background noise coming in. I hear kids and everything, so I'm not... You're the only one on, so maybe it's coming from your end, if you wouldn't mind.
It might be coming from my end. Let me see if I can move to a new location really quick.
Yeah, that'd be great. Meanwhile, I wanted to remind everyone that kanatarepublic.ca, it's very important to look over the site and look at the material posted so far, because one of the things these people's assemblies will be doing is not only debating the situation in their communities and voting to bring in laws and actions that are necessary on multiplicity of different issues that are of concern, including police brutality, court corruption, the trafficking of children in their communities, and so on. But also, the People's Assemblies will be electing delegates to the Constitutional Convention happening at the end of October in Toronto to establish the constitutional framework for the Republic in Kanata. So it's very important for people to recognize that these are governments in inception, if you like. This is local government returning power to the hands of the people themselves. And so that's something for people to get on board with now at the ground level. And again, if you want to be involved in this, write to republicofkanata@gmail.com. And there's going to be a lot more news on that. People are looking at around the middle of September for the convening of these public meetings and public assemblies, people's assemblies. So please stay tuned for that. Also, another thing coming out of last week, somebody was asking when they wrote in with feedback for the show. They're asking, what happened to that idea we voiced in a few weeks ago of having kind of an educational component to the show? And we are going to do that. That's in construction as we talk. We didn't want to just fly off half-cocked, so to speak, with these things. There are a number of people presenting and that who will be presenting these educational presentations on the common law, on aspects of Kanata, the proposed constitution, and so on. So we look forward to that as well.
All right, Kevin, does this sound any better?
It does, yeah. Actually, we just cut out a lot of that background noise, so that'd be great.
Great, sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. So one of the things we want to get into in the first half of the show, Ryan, is on itccs.org this week, there were posted what's called some questions to a war criminal, that is, a.k.a. Pope Francis or Jorge Bergoglio, 15 hard questions to him about his personal involvement in these crimes and the guilt of his institution. So why don't we kind of go over some of those questions, because it's certainly relevant to why we should be disestablishing this kind of institution.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, before we even get to that, I wanted to bring up an interesting point that's been exposed in the last couple of weeks in relation to those Planned Parenthood videos and the selling of fetuses that have been aborted, in some cases whole babies, body parts, and things like that. There was a new video that was released in the past week amidst the congressional squabbling over whether or not Planned Parenthood should be defunded. And the argument against it, which ties in with the work we do in relationship not just to the trafficking of these baby parts, but in relationship to how people view the Vatican as a criminal institution, and that is how a lot of congressmen, senators, and people who supported Planned Parenthood, regardless of the evidence and a lot of these videos that are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 hours long in some cases altogether, people will say, well, even though this is true and maybe Planned Parenthood is doing this, it doesn't matter because we need to keep them as an institution because they are helping some people. So I wanted to ask you and get your take, how can we apply that kind of an argument to a criminal institution such as the Vatican or a criminal who's been convicted such as a Jorge Bergoglio, somebody who people see as someone who can actually help people, but at the same time, they're convicted of all of these terrible crimes. How does that relate? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's. I'm glad you raised that, Ryan, not only because of the issue of the sale of baby parts, but also the whole question of the legal defense used all the time by guilty parties is that, yes, our institution has done some wrong, but it does good things, therefore you shouldn't come down on us. We're going to reform ourselves and things will turn out fine. Legally, that's a totally bogus argument because it's simple analogy. If there's somebody who's committed a crime, that his various acts of charity or contributions to charity do not weigh in to the fact of his guilt. It may be considered a mitigating factor if he's operating as a lone individual, but in an institutional context, the very fact the institution is operating in a criminal capacity means, as a whole, it doesn't have the right to operate. Its funds can be seized because they're being used for criminal purposes, and every member, officer of that criminal body is guilty under the law. That's why in Nuremberg, they didn't have to go about proving that this person in concentration camp was killed by this SS guard. They were collectively responsible for a crime against humanity. And the same thing applies. Yeah.
Does that include, let's say, donations to a particular group, whether it's Planned Parenthood or people who give money to the church?
Absolutely. Once a body is lawfully convicted, its funds do not have the right, it doesn't have the right to operate as a bona fide business or organization. The courts can and should seize the funds of those organizations. Now, if the courts aren't willing to do it, and here's the interesting part, the courts aren't willing to do it, the citizens, the people themselves have the obligation to do it. So if, for example, we go, and here's one example, the Los Angeles Diocese of the Catholic Church, which is being found guilty numerous times of trafficking children and then silencing the witnesses with payoffs. Any citizen in Los Angeles has the right to go into the Catholic Church there and take the funds and say, you don't have the right to have these funds because they're going to be used for criminal purposes, you know, lawyers for protecting child rapists and so on, especially in a body like the Catholic Church who stated policies to protect in-house rapists. So, you know, The only question then becomes, are people going to act on it? And we're providing them a framework by which they can act lawfully, not just as individuals, but as communities.
Well, whether it's the citizenry or it's a court, what happens to the money that is taken from these criminal establishments? Does it go back into the community?
If a court seizes it, it's held as a public asset. That means it can be held by a public trustee, which is really the government. But don't forget that under the American Constitution, the government is the people. So there isn't any differentiation between whether people do it lawfully and peacefully or whether a court does it. So of course that would be contested in court, but the point is, the constitutional model in America and hopefully soon in Canada will be that the people are the source of the law, therefore they can act in their own name to protect, for one thing, protect the children of a community from predatory Catholic priests.
Absolutely, Kevin. We were talking about these questions to a war criminal in relation to Pope Francis or Jorge Bergoglio,
And some of the ones that we had marked down specifically relate to an incident that happened on February 23rd and February 24th of last year, 2014. And I believe that had to do with a ritualistic killing, correct? Maybe connected to the Ninth Circle?
That's right. The very first question on the questions to him is, are you a member or participant in the sacrificial cult known as the Ninth Circle? Where were you at midnight on February 23rd, 24th, 2014? Now, that's on the basis of an eyewitness who contacted the ITCCS in Brussels and said that in the Jesuit church in Rome, San Lorenzo Church, in a sub-basement crypt, a sacrifice of a child occurred on that night, a young boy, on that, and you can probably tell us a little bit about the significance of that date, but I understand it was the Roman festival of Terminalia and Ferelia, where traditionally people, animals and children were sacrificed as part of a fertility cult. And we had strong evidence that Jorge Bergoglio, as a Jesuit, was present at that event.
Yeah, those dates are actually synonymous with the origins of Valentine's Day, which is a Roman fertility festival and a cleansing festival for a type of rebirth and regeneration called Lupercalia, where the Roman priests called the Luperci would actually gather in an underground crypt, kind of like the underground crypts under some of these churches, which represent the womb or the inside of the earth, which is a very female type of symbolism, and they perform sacrifices of animals and or children, and then they used the blood and the flesh in some cases, at least the Luperci did in Rome, and they'd go around the city and they would actually, in some cases, beat women with it as a sign of fertility, and women wanted to be struck with the hide of the goat or whatever animal was killed because they thought it would make them more fertile. That's less of a nefarious side to these rituals, but nevertheless, that's the origins of where they came from.
Well, and the reality is that these rituals continue to the present day because the Roman Empire has never changed. It took on a form called the Catholic Church, but its rituals and attitudes are still very much the same, that the blood of the innocent will redeem us, as it says.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, just recently we've had Bergoglio calling once again for a world government. That a couple of years ago, the Vatican's called for a world currency. Rome still very much operates through the Vatican, and that old Roman Empire never was really destroyed in the same sense that the Nazi powers of Germany were never really destroyed. They never surrendered. Only the country, Germany, Deutschland, surrendered, not the actual Nazi ideology. It's the same thing with the Roman ideologies. It never surrendered, and neither did the British crown. There's still an operational function today.
Well, here's another question that comes out of it, number 13 on the list to Bergoglio. Why are you beatifying, or making a saint, the murderous California missionary Junipero Serra, who led the Spanish conquest of Aboriginal nations there, enslaving and killing thousands of men, women, and children on Franciscan-run slave plantations? Now, Bergoglio the other day was referring to this missionary Junipero Serra, and he said, quote, "We are excited by his zeal," unquote. Now, that zeal included gathering up thousands of Indians, forcing them to convert or killing them on the spot. And there's George Tinker, who is an American Aboriginal scholar, has documented Serra's work on five different plantations. These were slave plantations the Catholics set up alongside the conquistadors. And they brought in natives, regardless of the age. If they wouldn't convert, they were murdered on the spot. And even those who were converted were set to work as slaves. And they were literally beaten to death and starved to death by this Junipero Serra. Now,
was this part of an Inquisition?
Well, the Inquisition was always operative in the conquistadors and the Franciscans when they would show up as, quote, missionaries. There was always a inquisitor along with them. So that's the thing. The native people were seen as heretics, just like a Protestant or a liberal or anybody else would be seen as. And the same laws of inquisitions applied. If you didn't convert, you could be anything could be done to you, up to including torture and death. So the very fact that Bergoglio would laud this murderer, this genocidal maniac in California, suggests exactly where his attitudes still remain, despite all the talk of reform.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think it was Bergoglio who just put a guy named Schellenberger, I think was his name, I think it was Schellenhuber, in charge of the Vatican Science Department. And this is a guy who has on several occasions. His main underlying ideology is the eradication of a large portion of the world's population for some form of population control, calling the population to bring in a world government. And that's who Pope Francis just announced was the new science advisor to the Vatican.
Well, that makes sense because, you see, the Vatican Bank invests heavily in not only Big Pharma, but a lot of the bioweapons division, and also the so-called global population reduction program that started in the UN as part of this Agenda 21. Significantly, Bergoglio, when he arrives in America in September, he'll be speaking at the UN at the Sustainable Development Conference, which is really the code word for depopulation. So this all overlaps a lot, you know.
Oh yeah, it does, and they always make it about the environment. They make it about nature while they're systematically involved in programs to eradicate mankind. It's completely backwards and complete hypocrisy. Right. But the point is, even if there is some legitimacy to a eugenicist argument, the fact that these people get to make the decisions on who lives or who dies is a completely different argument in and of itself. That's just something that is really, really crazy when you start to break it down and think about it, what their policies are and how they've tricked so many people, not just in the religious aspect, but in the political aspects of protecting the environment by eliminating huge portions of the population, programs that we see are already underway and have been for many years.
Now, let me mention, too, that just closing on this Junipero Serra thing, Bergoglio has not backed down on his intent to make this guy a saint. And in California, there's a big movement developed. They have a Facebook site. It's called the Junipero Serra Anti-Canonization Page. Just look that up on Facebook. That's J-U-N-I-P-E-R-O, Junipero, and then Serra, S-E-R-R-A, Anti-Canonization Page. They're having routine protests every first Sunday of the month outside the Los Angeles Cathedral, 555 West Temple Street in Los Angeles. And they're really taking on Bergoglio over this. Now, unfortunately, their perspective is very single issue. They're just seeing this in isolation. They're not talking about the ongoing crimes of the Vatican and how this very guy is helping protect child traffickers as we speak and child murderers. So hopefully people in California can start educating these folks that it isn't just something that happened 100 years ago.
That's right. It still happens today. One of the other questions that you proposed was relating to the Vatican Bank and the massive laundering of money for drug cartels, child trafficking, and things like that, but also involving Dragata. And maybe you could explain the connection there between the Vatican Bank and the Mafia.
Well, it's an old relationship. It goes back really to the founding of the Vatican Bank by Mussolini, the dictator, in 1929. You know, it's funny, when I was in Rome a number of times, but one of the times that we were meeting with some Italian senators, and this guy took me aside and said, you know, the thing you have to understand about Rome is that the Mafia and the government and the Vatican are all the same people. And this is a senior Democratic Party senator talking. He'd been in politics 50 years. I mean, you know, it's well known that they're all the same actors. And the one clear example of this is in the sacrificial rituals and the human hunting parties and these other things that the Ninth Circle cult have been engaged in for several hundred years through the Vatican. The children for this and the adolescents are provided by the mob through 'Ndrangheta, which is the Mafia's name in Europe. They're the biggest drug and human traffickers in that part of the world and almost the entire world. 'Ndrangheta will use their paid police and politicians and judges to get children out of youth detention centers, and then these kids disappear, or children out of orphanages, and then they're used in these Catholic-run rituals. And there's a lot of payback in both directions. And, you know, in return for laundering their money, they provide these kids for these rituals and a lot of other things. They're also joint, Vatican and the Mafia jointly own the largest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited in Italy. So, you know, landmine companies, the whole shebang. So again, when people put money in those collection plates on Sunday, that's the crime they're funding. And we have to stop people from doing that.
And one of the ways we do that is by informing them. Another question that was proposed that was in relation to 'Ndrangheta and the Vatican Bank And I'll actually read the question in relationship to Jorge Bergoglio. Did you or your representatives ever meet personally with leaders of Dringada in February of 2014 or at any other time to arrange these exchanges and other criminal acts? Do we have proof that there were meetings that took place, witnesses and whatnot, Kevin?
Yeah, we do. The meeting took place in Paris. And again, this was Paris every year is the where the Dringada have their kind of inner council meeting. And they've got strong ties with the French police and politicians, especially right-wing Catholic-oriented politicians. Strong ties with the National Front, the neo-Nazi group in France, which is heavily tied to some of the Catholic cardinals there. Anyway, they had the meeting in Paris at one of these Dringada inner council meetings in February, which was the same month that sacrifice occurred at San Lorenzo, and that's no coincidence. There was a Canadian cabinet minister, Denis Lebel, who was present at the sacrifice. And we believe there was also the same representatives at this Dringada meeting. Basically, at the meeting, one of the things that our informer told us about was that it was not only talking about these rituals and the need to try to conceal them more because the word was beginning to get out, including through a member of parliament in Belgium, Laurent Louis, who had named this in the Belgian parliament just the previous year. But also they were looking at ways of getting in with the action with the Russia and Chinese new banking cartel, which the Asian Investment Bank, which is trying to rival the World Bank in the East. And the Vatican money is increasingly going to Russia and China, which is a whole other story.
Now, what about the death of John Paul I in 1978? Is there a connection there? Does Bergoglio have any connection to that?
Well, basically what happened was he does have an indirect connection for sure. As people may or may not know, John Paul I began to kind of very mildly investigate the Vatican Bank because of its mob connections. And he wasn't totally a saint himself. He was actually backed by one faction, a thing called the Ambrosia Bank, Bank of Ambrosia from Milan, which is where he was from. And they were losing some of their assets to the mob involvement in the Vatican Bank. So he was acting in their behest to just kind of check out what kind of influence the mob had within the Vatican Bank. He was very kind of a naive guy. A faction of Catholic cardinals associated with Pope Benedict, Joseph Ratzinger, had the guy killed. They were part of what's called the P2 Lodge, and which is a Masonic lodge involving, it's a kind of a neo-Nazi group in Italy involving the top generals, politicians, billionaires. And they had, John Paul I poisoned. That's all been proved really well in a book called In God's Name by David Yellup. Anyway, these cardinals had the involvement of Pope Benedict, Joseph Ratzinger. Now, Bergoglio was in another faction in the Vatican who discovered this and was using it to lever Ratzinger out of power, which is what happened, although we still believe Ratzinger still holds a lot of the reins of power in Rome. And Bergoglio has done his best to cover this up because some of his friends might be implicated as well.
Well, I think the P2 Lodge is a very interesting study of the corruption of not just the government, but of the church, which the P2 Lodge of Freemasonry tied in with the Vatican Bank, they actually had a plan on a lot of the members. They had their homes raided by the Italian police. They had a plan to overthrow the government and install a fascist dictatorship, but also to infiltrate it and overthrow other governments in the world. And that was directed straight through the Vatican. And also it's interesting about Ratzinger. I wrote a little bit about him in the ICLCJ hearings in my book, False Prophets and the Lovers of Children. And there was a story about after Ratzinger resigned, how I think it was Reuters News that reported he's going to now live within this the city limits of Vatican City so that they will offer him, and this is a quote, legal protection from any attempt to prosecute him in connection with sexual abuse cases around the world. And other Vatican officials came out and said that, quote, his continued presence in the Vatican is necessary, otherwise he might be defenseless. He wouldn't have his immunity, his prerogatives, his security if he is anywhere else. So, I mean, that in and of itself, the simple fact that the Vatican even admitted that is more proof that he didn't necessarily just get shoved out for that reason, the blackmailing. It was because of the child trafficking and because of the providing of children.
it's a clear admission of guilt again. And again, the fact that they've never refuted any of these charges we brought, it's all up online at itccs.org, all the evidence. So I really urge people to follow that. We're right at the bottom of the hour, Ryan. Time goes quick. We're going to have a another short song. And then, again, we're replaying a statement by a survivor of the Mohawk Residential School in Brantford, Ontario, about what he witnessed. After that, we're going to come back on and bring the focus back onto Kanata and more at home what we can be doing.
There's a man walking around the island with a snake king. Picked it up in Thailand from a hurricane. And you know he's not gonna go there. He's been one time too long. Now all the gods are gone.
Here we are, second day of the dig near the mush hole. And this is an area about 100 yards from the school where we found consistent bone samples, and these regular types of buttons, probably off of, well, clothing obviously, but the interesting thing is here and at the Glebe site, they're of the same style as if they're off a standard uniform or something. Could be a child's button off a school uniform.
My name is Del Riley. I'm a member of the Chippewa of the Thames. And I spent 5 years in the Canadian government calls it residential schools, but really these were prisoner of war camps. I was one in the one called the Mohawk Institute, and I do believe it had the reputation of being the worst of all the residential schools, if there is such a thing, because they were all horrible. But I did 5 years here. And it was a most horrific experience any human being could possibly go through. And probably from being every one of the 6-year-olds I was in here was sexually abused, and myself as well, multiple times, multiple, and in double-digit figures, so every one of them. It didn't happen to all of us. And they starved us, beat us, froze us, and it was horrific. There was no controls in the place. Kids were always getting beat up or being put through various torture rituals. Well, I want the story to come out. I want the world to know what has happened to the kids here. The fact that thousands upon thousands were killed here. It was a holocaust for our kids. And then have to suffer now through the fact that most of those little kids they killed off, nobody knows who they were, where they're buried, what home. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but we have to deal with that.
And we're back. This is Radio Free Kanata. That was Del Riley of the Chippewa Nation. I met Del when we were doing the dig at the Mush Hole in 2011, early 2012. And, you know, he said a simple fact, you know, thousands of these children died, yet in Canada, not a single person was ever and has never been brought to trial for any of those deaths, except in our common law court trial. And there's a simple reality, Ryan, that when an institution and a whole regime like Canada not only commits genocide, but admits to it, which is what they did in June, they admitted genocide occurred. You know, they might have put the word adjective cultural in front of it, but cultural, physical, or biological genocide, it's all the same thing under international law. It's equally guilty, equally an offense. And so for them to admit it and then nothing to happen means there are responsibilities on the people themselves to walk away from those institutions. And that's been really the basis of Kanata and what we're doing. So I wanted to close off on these 15 questions by looking at the very last one. And it says, having been lawfully convicted of these and other crimes,
And since an international arrest warrant has been issued against you, Jorge Bergoglio, will you continue to evade and obstruct justice? Or will you surrender yourself to that justice and the verdict of this court in humanity? Now, you know, the short answer is, of course, no, they won't. But that doesn't stop what we can do and should be doing. So why don't we get into that kind of discussion? There's a lot of stuff we want to raise. Go ahead, Ryan, your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I wanted to say, listening to that testimony there, for anybody that comes out and says that because they've never heard witness testimony, or they're just kind of blinded by this arrogant ignorance of these crimes and of these actions by church and by state, whether it's directly or indirectly, the people that call this a conspiracy, or the people that say that it didn't happen because of some subconscious protection of these father figure type beings, whether they're in the church or they are in the government, it's very ironic to me how they claim that this is a conspiracy or that this is insane, yet there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of witnesses to these crimes. You know, you've spoken to hundreds of them yourselves, yourself, who have they were in the residential schools. You'd have to also believe at the same time it'd be a form of cognitive dissonance to believe that all of these people from different walks of life all over the world have experienced these same types of actions by the church, have experienced these same types of abuses, and have come together in some global conspiracy to bring the church down. You'd really start to have to believe that if you wrote off all this evidence to the contrary. So I wanted to say that first of all. I mean, do you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a strange phenomenon, because when the guilt of somebody is presented to them, the denial kicks in immediately, and the bigger the crime and the more people it involves, the bigger the denial process. So, I mean, you have that. For example, still to this day, the Canadian government will say in through its official websites, and their stage-managed Truth and Reconciliation Commission says this still on their Facebook site, that it's true that thousands of children died, but it wasn't intentional.
There's negligence, happened, as they call it.
Well, yeah, it happened, they claim, because of poor funding. Well, first of all, if you don't fund people and they starve to death, that's contributing to a death. That's at a minimum, criminal negligence and second-degree murder right there. But that whole thing about underfunding is completely bogus, because by doing that, it's just distracting from the fact that intentional killing was going on all the time, and they know it. We've got the proof in letters and in eyewitness testimonies. So, you know, that's they keep raising these red herrings, and because they run the system, they can get away with it, because all of us think, oh, well, we can't really go up against them. Aren't they in power? But here's a very, very famous quote. Those with power have it not because they have it, but because others think they have it.
Exactly.
If we realize and wake up to the fact that they don't have the power except what we give them, they will collapse tomorrow. And this is why we're forming these people's assemblies and doing the Republic.
That's right, Kevin. To touch on the question that you proposed to Jorge Bergoglio about will you continue to evade and obstruct justice, even though the institution has been criminally convicted, you've been criminally convicted, when will you surrender yourself to justice and the verdict of this court and humanity? And the answer that I would propose to that is going back into what we talked about last week with Agenda 21. And a lot of the people that run these programs, whether it's for carbon taxes, people like Al Gore and Marie Strong making billions of dollars, people that run these fake green programs, or any program, whether it's an institution or an agency like the CPS where they're making money, or even Planned Parenthood making money off the selling of body parts when they're supposed to help mothers and not abort their children and force them to have these abortions and whatnot. I think that a lot of these people are, first of all, so blind because they have been conditioned by the rhetoric of whatever agency or institution they're involved in. But second of all, a lot of the people, the big dogs at the very top, if you will, within the church and within state governments, I think a lot of them actually believe that the actions they take and the beliefs that they have in themselves as being somehow superior to everybody else, like Henry Kissinger said, soldiers on the front lines are dumb animals. And that's the kind of mentality that these people have. So in their mind, they didn't do anything wrong. It doesn't matter if a criminal court or if a court convicts them of criminal negligence or criminal activity of any sort. I really truly think that these people are so arrogant and so blinded by the power that they perceive they have because of the acquiescence of the population that they really truly do not think they've done anything wrong.
Right.
And they can train psychologically. The Vatican is very famous for psychological warfare. As a matter of fact, the P2 Lodge of Freemasonry and the Vatican Bank, they were both intimately tied with the Central Intelligence Agency here in the United States. So I think... Yeah. And they still are, absolutely. So I think that they've been able to train people to know or to believe that there's a certain sect of society that is more intelligent, that can make the better decisions for everybody else. And that's why if these people tell them that we need to eradicate a portion of the population to help save the environment, everybody thinks it's going to be somebody else. They don't think it's going to be them. And I think that's the bottom line for it, Kevin. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, the thing is that, again, our focus ultimately is not even on the criminals in power. They're not even the issue. Wolves are going to do what they do. It's the question of the so-called sheep and getting them to stop being sheep that, for me, is the main issue. And, before we get into that, I want to just say something. I got an email request from somebody to just say briefly they wanted to know the evidence for intentional murder in residential schools. And to sum it up, here's the proof. There was a 10-year period between 1919 and 1929, and these are the following things that happened. Peter Bryce was a doctor. He published a report showing that the average death rate in the residential schools was over 50% every year, and that carried on till well into the 1950s. Okay. He published those reports. He was fired and driven out of the civil service. Despite the enormous death rate in residential schools, the next year, the government did two things. They made it mandatory for every Indian child to go into those death traps, and they banned all medical inspection in the residential schools. Okay? You force kids into a murderous situation where smallpox and TB are rampant, and then you ban medical inspection so nobody can see. So, obviously a situation trying to create murder. The same 4 years later, 1924, laws were brought in preventing any Indian from hiring a lawyer. 1929, the churches are made the legal guardian over all Indians, and the first sterilization laws are brought in. Now, in that 10-year period, clearly, all of that, when you look at the timeline and how one thing follows from another, clearly there's an intent by the government and churches to wipe out Indians, take away their legal rights, bring in sterilization laws, and cloak the residential schools from any inspection. And making it mandatory for the kids to go into those death traps. When you put all those facts together, it's clear intention, yet nobody is ever allowed to put the facts together. Those facts aren't even shared, and then they're broken up so nobody can see the pattern.
You're exactly right. As a matter of fact, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the same year, 1933, when the Sterilization Act was passed in British Columbia, it's the same year that Adolf Hitler passed the Sterilization Act in Germany, and the same year that was part of where the Nazis got their idea for eugenics and euthanasia was in the United States. We actually had experiments against the black population and other minority groups to exterminate them, one called the Tuskegee Experiment in Alabama, and that was also in 1933. So these are parallel programs on different continents at the same time.
Right. And don't forget, this death rate carried on, and here's the other vital piece of information that nobody's ever published but me. In 1889, the year the first residential school opened in the West, by the end of the year, half those kids were dead. Yet that's over 50% death rate the first year in the first schools in Alberta. And yet on the reservations, the death rate was only 3-4%. So why would you have an enormous increase unless they were being deliberately killed off in the residential schools from the very first year?
And that's right. It was consistent.
Consistent right up until 1949. That's a 60-year period where there was another report of a 50% death rate. After the war, they began to closet it more and hide it more. So that death rate wasn't as obvious. But when you add it all up, it's clear intentional genocide, and the institutions that did it have lost the right to govern, church or state.
Well, here's my question. How many years ago did you bring out the Bryce documents?
First published in 1998, officially. That's 17 years.
Okay, so that's almost two decades ago. And for almost two decades, you've been ridiculed and laughed at, and everybody told you you were crazy for the most part, with the exception of people who knew what was going on and wanted to fight it.
And then just recently, amidst all that ridicule that you've and others have incurred over the years, Kevin, the Canadian government admits that there were deaths in those schools, thousands of deaths. And if I actually read some of the official report, and even though they claim that only one child per school per year died or some insane number like that, they said that it was possible, quote unquote, possible that 6,000 or more children could have actually died outside of the TRC investigation, which was more open admittance of what had actually happened. So the point is, you brought these documents out so long ago, and amidst all of the disinformation that's been put up about you, the government actually comes out and says, look, the children did die. And obviously your name's not brought up, any information what you exposed is not brought up. But look, the fact is you were right from the beginning and they even admitted it. That's the point that I'm at. You have to see those facts. It's ridiculous.
I know, but you see, the thing is, Ryan, that they have to continue excluding me from any mention. And ever since the apology came out in 2008, the official whitewash, my name has never been allowed to be mentioned in any of the corporate media in Canada. I'm always referred to as a controversial West Coast minister. Never Kevin Annett.
Well, of course, because I can't give credibility to anything else you say.
No, and I'm not part of the spin, so I would be an alternative voice. Now, the reason they're going to so much trouble isn't just because they hate me. It's not about me at all. It's the fact that they know that under international law, they are a rogue nation. And on the UN Convention on Genocide, it says every signatory and every nation in the world has the obligation to prosecute and punish genocide. That means Canada should be now facing economic sanctions, trade and tourism boycotts, the arrest of their public officials, the people responsible, and the disestablishment of those criminal churches, Anglican, United, Catholic churches. They know that that's going to happen if somebody pushes the envelope. So this is why Kanata is on the up front and center now, because it's the only alternative for people in Canada who don't want to live under a criminal regime. There's no alternative.
Right, and the same types of republics have to be established all across the world in different countries, whether it's Canada or the United States.
Right.
Anywhere one of these criminal bodies exists, they need to be disestablished, which many of them have under common law courts and criminal convictions to the heads of state and prime ministers and heads of church and whatnot. And then we have to establish these republics and work through the guidelines of the common law courts to do that.
Right. Now, to remind people, itccs.org has the common law training manual on it. CanadaRepublic.ca has the community sheriff training manual. And we've only got about 5 minutes or less here, so I just want to close on that note to lead into next week, that we're going to be having, once again, organizers on to talk about how they're planning to establish these people's assemblies in September. These people's assemblies are the legislative body of the new republic from the grassroots up. They're going to elect delegates to the Constitutional Convention. They're going to lawfully establish common law courts and policing bodies such as community sheriffs and citizen militias. And they're setting up things like land commissions to peacefully take back the land and the wealth of Kanata and redistribute it. Now, this is a model. There's a group on the west coast of America in Northern California that's trying to set up the same program for America, going back to its constitutional roots. There's a big movement in America to establish this. So this is really spreading, and I really encourage people to get on board with this. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com, and stay tuned next week on the 16th of August, where we're going to be having more of the organizers back on the air to talk about the practical work they've been doing. So, Ryan, any final thoughts?
Yep, two things come to mind. As a matter of fact, I know towards the end of the month, I'll be having you and maybe some others from the Republic come on to my radio show, The Secret Teachings, to discuss these topics. And we do a 3-hour show a couple times a week, so a lot more information in one setting. And also, I've been able to get Radio Free Kanata put onto another network to play reruns, so that's really good news. And the other thing that comes to mind is tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, my show, The Secret Teachings, airs. You can find all of the information at thesecretteachings.info. That's thesecretteachings.info. Tonight is the third part of a 4-part series on the history of Agenda 21, biodiversity, and sustainable developments. All of that tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Thesecretteachings.info is the website. And there's also a link on my website to Radio Free Kanata, the website with the archive and whatnot.
That's great news, Ryan. Thank you. And just in closing as well, people should know that public television in the U.S. has begun to broadcast our YouTube postings about these crimes of genocide, the Republic of Kanata, and these other issues we've talked about. It's takes in an area in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Northern California, and Washington. This is now reaching millions of television viewers, and they have the means to get other public television networks to pick this up and broadcast it. So in the fall, we are establishing a Republic News Network, RNN, which will be broadcasting these things to local television and radio across Kanata, really across the entire continent. So again, this is in the works. This is going to be established through the People's Assemblies, and we ask you all to go from listening to these things and having a passive commitment to becoming actively involved in establishing the Republic in your community, whether that's in America, Canada, or wherever. So, Ryan, any final thoughts about that?
Yeah, I actually have one more thought that came to mind while you were speaking, and that is, and I used to be in this this mindset a couple of years ago, but it's kind of evaporated. For anybody that says that they're aware of what's going on, whether it's child abuse, Agenda 21, whatever the case might be, and they say that they want something to be done about this, but they just don't know what to do. Well, these people's assemblies and these common law courts and the stuff that we're working on, Kevin, and others that are in our group and that are in the Republic with us, this is what is being done to take back our rights and to take back our liberties and freedoms from these criminal institutions of church and state. This is what's being done. So if anybody wants to actually stand up and do something about the problems that we face, you have to join with people like us who are taking active action and doing those things. So I just wanted to say that because it's very important.
Well, that's right. And as well, it can be very daunting if you look at the whole problem. But if you start in your own community and realize, yes, we can form these assemblies that meet regularly. We can ask the police to come and learn about the common law in our workshops that we'll be setting up. We can start getting people in the system on our side. And in fact, it's already begun. So we're going to be going into that in more detail next week. Please tune in again. Keep telling people about the links, kanatarepublic.ca, K-A-N-A-T-A. It means our village in the Haudenosaunee language, kanatarepublic.ca. And we appreciate all your feedback and the growing number of listeners. So until next week, stay strong, act on what you know. We'll talk to you soon.